You're listening to WRCT, and this is Anatomy of the Ear on Sunday, the final day of Anatomy of the Ear, and I'm August Personage. We're doing the Bakersfield sound, getting close to halfway through the hour, and we heard songs from the likes of Joe and Rosalie Mathis, Wanda Jackson, Bonnie Bluebell, the Farmer Boys. That was a bit more towards the rockabilly side of things for a couple of songs there. And then after that, we heard two from Gene Shepherd, Harold Cox and the Sooners, and one from Glenda Blackwell, I Want to Live in Your House. Incidentally, I'm forever grateful for Bear Family Records and their compilation, The Bakersfield Sound, Country Music Capital of the West, 1940 to 1974, for being such an excellent resource for jumping into the breadth of this music. Now here's Buck Owens.
I've got a tiger by the tail, it's plain to see. I won't be much when you get through with me. Well, I'm a losing weight and I'm turning mighty pale. Looks like I've got a tiger by the tail. Well, I thought the day I met you were meek as a lamb, just the kind to fit my dreams and plans. Now the pace we're living takes the wind from my sails, and it looks like I've got a tiger by the tail. I've got a tiger by the tail, it's plain to see. I won't be much when you get through with me. Well, I'm a losing weight and I'm turning mighty pale. Looks like I've got a tiger by the tail. Got a tiger by the tail. I've got a tiger by the tail, it's plain to see. I won't be much when you get through with me. Well, I'm a losing weight and I'm turning mighty pale. Looks like I've got a tiger by the tail.
You're sick and tired of how I'm doing, and you're gonna head off down the track. But darling, before you go, be sure you know how much I love you, and that I'm sorry for the quarrel that we had. If you leave, you're gonna tear my world to pieces. So take it slow, be sure you know before you go. Oh, your wounded pride has blinded your reason, and right now you want to hurt me. Waiting here to take you to the station, and you're leaving with your ticket in your hand. But darling, before you go, be sure you know how much I love you, and that I'm sorry for the quarrel that we had.
If you leave, you're gonna tear my world to pieces. So take it slow, be sure you know before you go. Heart and let my love come in. I know you've been hurt by an old love affair, but darling, don't blame me, I wasn't even there. Your long, lonely nights I will bring to an end when you open up your heart and let my love come in. Open up your heart and let my love come in. Open up your heart and let my life begin. The sun's gonna shine, there'll be blue skies again when you open up your heart and let my love come in. Has made your heart hurt. Your long, lonely nights I will bring to an end when you open up your heart and let my love come in. Open up your heart and let my love come in. Open up your heart and let my life begin. The sun's gonna shine, there'll be blue skies again when you open up your heart and let my love come in. When you open up your heart and let my love come in.
Well, I pulled out of Pittsburgh, rolling down that eastern seaboard. I got my diesel wound up, she's a-running like never before. There's a speed zone ahead, well, all right. I can dodge all the cops in sight. 6 days on the road and I'm gonna make it home tonight. I got 10 Ford gears and a Georgia overdrive. I'm taking little white pills and my eyes are open wide. I just passed a Jimmy and a white. I've been a-passing everything in sight. 6 days on the road and I'm gonna make it home tonight. Well, it seems like a month since I kissed my baby goodbye. I could have a lot of women, but I'm not that kind of a guy. I could find one to hold me tight, but I could never make believe it's all right. 6 days on the road and I'm gonna make it home tonight. CC is a checking on down the line. I'm a little overweight and my logbook's way behind. But nothing bothers me tonight. I can dodge all the scales all right. 6 days on the road and I'm gonna make it home tonight. My rig's a little old, but that don't mean she's slow. She's got a flame from her stack and that smoke's a blowing black as coal. Well, my hometowns are coming in sight. If you think I'm happy, you're right. 6 days on the road and I'm gonna make it home tonight. 6 days on the road and I'm gonna make it home tonight. 6 days on the road and I'm gonna make it home tonight. 6 days on the road and I'm gonna make it home tonight.
I gotta get a going cause I'm running late. These mountain grades are mighty steep. Can't stay awake, I ain't had no sleep. Diesel smoke, danger's curve. Cute little waitress at the bottom of the grade. She's got the coffee already made. I gotta keep my eyes upon the road, cause I'm going down the hill with a heavy load. Diesel smoke, danger's curve. Well, I must have closed my eyes for a while, cause here I am and I'm a running wild. I burnt my brakes, stripped my gears, gonna have to ride her down, I fear. Diesel smoke, danger's curve. I wish I'd have left the women alone, but it's too late now, cause I think I'm gone. I got myself into this fix just because I tried to mix. Diesel smoke, danger's curve. Diesel smoke, danger's curve.
Okay. got them wondering, Kate. All the truckers are asking who's the gal in the little pink Mac. Would you believe? All the truckers are asking who's the gal in the little pink Mac. Oh, boy. All the truckers are asking who's the gal in the little pink Mac.
Here's Biff Adam on the drums. And Dennis Romack on the bass. Bobby Wayne on rhythm guitar. Mr. Norman Hamlet on the steel. And Roy Nichols on the lead electric guitar. And I'm Merle Haggard, and I'm introducing the Strangers with a song they wrote themselves entitled Stealing Corn. One and two and three and four. Thank you, boys.
Some wealthy ones like you laugh down on the common folk like me and making bets to what degree of fool we are. From your rose-colored windows, you see yourself above us, standing in the mud and gazing at the stars. But the rich and poor have in common the common cold, the heartburn, and the heartache, and put our pants on just the same. Now your wealth don't make you better, babe, 'cause I can't tread water, babe, as long as you think you can make it rain. While you got your raisin girl in your diamond-studded world, I got pulled up on the hungry side of town. Cut my teeth on bacon rind, and ain't no hide as thick as mine, but it might be fun a while to be your clown. So get your whip and do your thing, and I'll run around the ring riding a white horse wearing an arm or two. Ah, but I don't easy bliss to be, and I'll be your court just a bit, but don't think you won't pay the fiddler too. Back when you put your hand in mine, it was a shocking thing to find the water hot, the current strong, deep and wet. You had me struggling for time, dangling on your line. Oh, but never fear, this fish never sweat. While you're playing with my mind, I'll be playing with your money, honey, as long as your account can stand the drain. I'll fan the flame and make it hotter, 'cause I think I can walk on water, long as you can make it rain. Think if I hang around a while, study your style, I'll come out a whole lot wiser, man, at least. 'Cause the last time anyone as grand as you appeared, they looked around, found a brand new star up in the east. Hey, but I don't see no halo, just a little girl with a lot of gold, wanting one more drinking for your golden chain. Well, you got a hot one hanging, kid, don't let them say you never did your best, be my guest, make it rain. Oh, make it rain. Babe, make it rain.
Make it rain. another. Well, she got right up and she walked right out the door. Well, you know she didn't love you, this one thing you knew. But you need a vaccination, a shot for the blues. I sit and wonder and I cry, cry, cry. I get so lonely I could die, yes, die. I know if you came back, you'd probably be untrue. But I'd need a vaccination, a shot for the blues. And I'd need a vaccination, a shot for the blues.
WRCT Pittsburgh, WRCT.org. Welcome to Ebony Spectrum. Let's take a listen to Karen Hunter and others.
There's a lady named Ellie Way. She's unmelanated. She tweeted, I don't know if Ryan Coogler intended this, though I feel that he must have on some level. Did you see this tweet?
Right before we came.
Okay. But Sinners left me with a real sense of grief over the disconnect I feel from my cultural heritage. I'm a white American, and I have no idea where I came from. I have no cultural roots to draw from. My past is just empty.
Did you see somebody?
Yeah, somebody said, so you ain't see the Klan in the movie? But see, you know what,
that's cold. That's cold, no, man.
No. So I felt her because yesterday I had a caller, because I asked for it. I asked for somebody to call up, and he still didn't answer my question. But I'm challenging people who identify with this made-up construct of whiteness.
Right.
To do exactly what she's doing.
Yeah,
ask yourself why.
Yeah.
Are you Irish? Are you Italian?
It was cold that they picked her when she was down like that. That's all. Like, it's funny, but it's kind of cold. Y'all ain't had to do her. Like, y'all knew what she was trying to say.
But I'm saying, why identify with the Klan? And I'm glad that Ellie didn't identify with the Klan.
Yeah, of course.
So she's like, that ain't me. Them ain't my people. I'm not identifying with that. And I'm saying, in this era where everybody's trying to remove books and stuff, well, not everybody, Trump and his people and the daughters of Knuckle Dragon Liberty and all of the stuff, trying to remove books because it makes their children feel bad. Why do you raise your children to identify with the Klan, with the colonizers, with the rapists, with the genociders? Why not?
Right.
Why not tell them a different...
Yeah. My question for her is twofold. There's 2 points. The first point is, I actually love that Ryan Coogler didn't put the cool white people in it. I'm not saying that I like movies that do that. There's a time and place for that. I like that this wasn't about that. It wasn't like, and here's the white people on the Underground Railroad. It was like, no, that they weren't part of this story. But the second thing is, it's interesting she chose to say she couldn't relate, because the characteristics in those characters are universal characteristics. They are not black only characteristics. Bravery is a universal characteristic. A spirituality is a universal characteristic, right? Like, you don't have to, I don't know nothing about hoodoo, but I was looking at one, mean like, right. Oh my God, you know, I feel that. That's my auntie, you know? And so you don't have to be black to understand. Even when you talk about moonshine or being a gangster, that's not a black only thing. Music is not black only, like, as evidenced by them doing that damn jig. Like, it's not. So that's stuff to identify with. You don't have to come at it from a cultural racial angle. You won't identify with it the same as a black American, but honestly, it's about damn time we had some. So let us have this one, and you can go watch any Wes Anderson film you want and you'll get the vibes.
Right That part. But, you know, it is sad because whiteness is a made up construct that is it forces people into a criminal enterprise and forces them to defend it. Right. If you want to be a part of it. And that's a hell of a thing for the majority of people in this country to have to align themselves with the Trail of Tears and enslavement and all. Like, why should they have to fly a Confederate flag? When you look at a Trump rally and you see a Confederate flag, like, you fought the, you what, 90% of the people out there that lost their lives during the Civil War fighting for enslavement didn't own anybody.
Didn't own slaves.
So they're fighting. So you're telling me you and your people fighting to want to own somebody? Like, is this who you are? Like, at some point, there's got to be a reckoning on this narrative, and you're fighting to preserve your whiteness when DNA-wise, ask the South Africans.
Yes.
There's a Skin. I talk about this movie, Skin. Sophie Okonedo plays a girl born into a white family, but she turned out looking like you. Because the DNA, I learned that in biology, 10th grade.
Right.
Recessive versus dominant, which is why this whole notion of an Aryan master race makes no biological sense. And every scientist that's out there talking about it, your DNA will always fight you.
Right.
Silly rabbits.
Might as well be talking about phrenology or whatever. But it's so interesting because what I mean is the limits of her imagination. Because her mind is trapped in whiteness. So she's like, I can't identify with this. And the reason I pointed out this specific way is because as black people, all of us understand. We've all had to watch stories we weren't part of, and we identified. are every single one of us. We watched a story that didn't have a place where they put black people in it. And we walked out of there and we still found ourselves.
Hold on, Rod. I got to get off. I just got a DM. I'm sorry. Let's go to line 7. No. Come on through, Cornbread. Cornbread, Omar Miller in Los Angeles is on the line. You better stop playing with me, sir.
What's happening?
Hello.
Oh, you know.
I may never be a filmmaker, but he inspires me to be even better at the thing.
How are things?
Listen, I'm sorry you got like that, but you went too far to the bathroom. Why you ain't just go around to the... How you... Go all the way.
There was no answer. If you go outside the juke, they got you either way it goes.
Yeah, well, that's true. But then you ain't had to come back and get the people like that. Talk about, can we just all get along? I said, man, why are you trying to get the people got?
How many takes did they give you?
That's why.
How many takes did they give you? Did you improv any of that, like getting back in and stuff? Because that seemed real fun.
It was a lot of fun. And it was I improv a lot of it. But Ryan's writing is so solid that he had the essence of what we were trying to do. So I just stayed within that with the improv. But if you look at it from a symbolic and a metaphoric standpoint, I did a lot of my presses go around with Delroy Lindo, the Fabulous Thespian. Mm. And he described the film in this great way, is that it's a film about a vibrant community that gets infiltrated by outsiders and then turns on itself. And you see what it is. And like my character is a catalyst, because once he comes back and he's trying to get in, from that point forward, you were on the full speed roller coaster. It really picks up from that point. You see it from a metaphoric standpoint. The character is trying to get back in to do to his own people what has been done to him, which is so deep.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Omar, can you listen? First of all, how'd you end up here? You driving around? And you just said, I'm going to call in to the camera at the show. What did somebody tell you got to call in? What happened?
No, not at all. I listen to your show all the time. I've been listening to your show for a long time.
Miller's listening. This is so, I'm so humbled right now. First of all, I fell in love with you on Ballers, right? Ballers,
you
were my dude. Okay.
Thank you.
And see you in this role, I mean, I just absolutely love your humanity. It just shows, it comes through in everything that you do. And even this, I didn't want Cornbread to get got like that. Your
me
wife
neither,
right
man.
Now, I said, oh, no.
Why I had to be Cornbread?
Not Cornbread. Then you. Oh, my goodness. All right, so I'm going to need you to hold on, because I have 11 billion questions for you. So Ron and I are just here giving out tickets, you know, to sinners and chopping it up with the people. And then on line 7, there's a guy named Omar and Cali. And then the screener said, it's Omar from Sinners, Cornbread. I was like, no way. And it's him. So crazy. Omar's sticking around. Omar Benson Miller. Shout out to his brother, Terry, who's also listening. How did you get the role? And how many people did you have to audition? And were you up against a bunch of folk for this role? Because it's pivotal.
It's pivotal. And you know what's funny is that I actually met Coogler years ago, probably like 15, 16 years ago, at the Miracle of St. Anna. I was getting an award, a Rising Star Award, at the Pan-African Film Festival, and he was still in college. And he was interning at the award show, and he came up to me afterwards, I was with my brother, with my mom, with my family, and he said, man, I love your stuff. I'm going to work with you one day. And as I'm apt to do, I was like, yeah, brother, I'll see you there. And little did I know, he was about to turn into Ryan Coogler. And, you know, he clearly turned it up between True Bell and Creed and Panther, and I got a call that he wanted to meet up, and so I said okay, and I walked in. He sent some materials. Everything was super high classified, you know, they kept it all under wraps. So he sent some material, and I came in, and the first thing he did was apologize that I didn't have any audition. And I was like, man, this dude is as humble as they come. That's part of the job, you know. Sometimes I audition, sometimes I don't. That's, you know, that it is what it is. That's how the game works. But I'm capable of auditioning. And so we had the audition process in the room. He was like, oh, yeah, it's exactly how I knew it was going to be. Which, you know, kind of indicated to me that there was maybe somebody else who had questions about whether or not I was the right person. And next thing I know, about 2-3 weeks later, I was on a plane to New Orleans to make the film. And man, oh, man, has he become a part of my life, man. That brother, to use the vernacular, protect Ryan Coogler at all costs. He's a very righteous, solid young man.
Yes.
Are you going to finesse your way into Black Panther 3?
That's up to him. Like, they don't finesse him. I'm not even trying to be shy. If Ryan calls, then we on set. Count on us.
You should like, was you trying to like sneak in an African accent on set just to show him like you could do it?
The Black Panther is stripped.
Where is the craft services table?
Oh. No, I don't know. The power of the Blick is, you know, that's my man. That's my man, Forrest Whitaker. That's already there. And everybody always getting us confused anyway. So I try to tread lightly.
He could be
you could play
son.
His son.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Black Panther 3.
We got a role. Okay.
That. Y'all done Omar, already cast the movie.
Omar Benson Miller, when did you know? Because I'll be honest. When I saw the trailer, I was like, I'll wait for the streamers. Because, I got 50 all of the streamers. I ain't going to the theater. People breathing on me to see no damn vampire movie. I love Ryan Coogler, but then I don't know what it was that made me like actually go get a ticket, sit in the theater, because I don't really do that. When did you know this was going to be special? Because I think a lot of us didn't know until we sat there. When did you know?
Oh, no, I knew when as soon as we started filming, because you know what? Ryan creates such a special atmosphere. The dude has an athletic background, and he's like a great coach. Everything is respectful, familial. I've never been on a more egalitarian set in my life. Mm. The young man knows everybody by name. It's 200 people on set. He knows every single person by name. And, he produces with his wife. He has his lifelong friends that he produces his films with. His mama came to set. I was like, okay, this dude was on to something. And then when we started to shoot, and I would see the stuff that Autumn was doing, and he and I actually spoke about what the history, how he came up with the script. And we found out that we shared a bond because his family was from Mississippi and migrated to Northern California, whereas my family was from Mississippi and were sharecroppers and migrated to Southern California. And so we got on really well. And then about a quarter of the way through the production, one day we were at work and Mike came up to me. He was like, hey, man, you got to come to the monitor. My knees were screaming. My feet were screaming. I was like, man, I'm cool because I don't really like to watch myself while we're filming. He's like, no, come now. All right, man. So we go over there and we watch some footage. And Mike looked at me and he said, hey, I think we got one. I know Mike for like 20 years. We just never worked together. And it was around that time that I started to see the stuff that we were doing and how his vision was coming to life from the page to the screen to what we were filming. And I was like, oh, man, this is going to be something special. Then when he called me and he showed it to me, myself, Miles Caton that plays Preacher Boy, Jack O'Connell that plays Rennick, and Delroy Lindo, we all sat together and watched the film. And I mean, it's the first time that I've had a film that I'm in that lands on me as if I'm not in it, like I'm in the audience. The film is beautiful. You can't tell me nothing about this one. I mean, I absolutely love this film.
Besides the scene that everybody's talking about in the juke joint the chain gang, which I heard that was complete ad lib by Delroy Lindo, like it wasn't scripted that way. What scene for you stood out like for the ages besides those two?
In all honesty, the Irish jig. The Rocky Road to Dublin scene is so key. It's such a key turning point in the story. And, you know, I heard you guys speaking before and you're spot on. All this stuff was well thought out. Ryan made sure that the vampire was Irish because the Irish people were enslaved like we were enslaved. So there's another dastardly level to the vampire that then in turn actually is luring other people through some sympathy and some empathy to the dark side. And you can go on for hours about that from a symbolic and from a metaphorical place. But we were out there that night. We had a hard time shooting this film because the Juke is actually set on a bayou and there's a swamp. Alligators walked on set. There was chiggers in the ground. It was 100 degrees at night. Like this film was hard to make, really hard to make. And meanwhile, at that point, I'm there in the circle and the sun is about to come up. And we had to chase the sun to make sure that we got the shots. So Jack had to be on his game. You're watching Mike at this point playing Stack, and he's completely focused on the new joy that he has from his false passion and happiness of his eternal life that he's been given from the devil, if you will. And to see everybody at the top of their game, because we didn't have a lot of time. There wasn't a lot of takes. And to watch everybody at the top of their game and to see what that meant as a transition in the film, because they're connected through the music. You know, this is why Sammy is so appealing to him. It's his natural God-given talent, the music. And you can see Remick, the vampire, is totally and completely offended when we tell him he can't come in the juke because of his skin color. He can't believe that. He's devastated because he really does believe in the music. And he really does believe in the power of the music, you know. And it's really interesting because shortly after that, this is when he goes into a shot at colonization. There's so much in the film to cover. I mean, don't even get me started because we could do a symposium on all the different stuff in the films.
We should.
Speaking back to that piece. Let me get this. I'm sorry to cut you off quick. Speaking back about that piece about you guys, how you had the pastor on. You know, when I first read the script and he was basically doing the baptism of Sammy and he drops into lockstep with him on the Lord's Prayer, that's when I read the script and I was like, okay, I need to see where this is going to go because I might not be able to do this from a personal belief standpoint. And then one of the things that I think connects with people and makes them see the film multiple times is what he says. And when he goes into the Lord's Prayer, Remick says something so powerful. He said, these were the words forced upon me by the men who stole my land and killed my people. And I hated those men, but I still find comfort and truth in their words. So it is speaking deeply about religion, about colonization, about the word of God itself. It's well worth your time if anybody's on the fence. I think the biggest thing to know is that this is not a vampire movie. There's a movie with vampires in it, but this is not a vampire movie by any means.
Yeah, I agree. What's next, man? What you got cooking on next? Or are you tired of people asking that question already?
Oh, you never get tired of that. I mean, I'm of the mind that it's always better, never best. So I'm on to the next. I made a wonderful film in Italy that I'm waiting to find out when it comes out stateside because I would love people to see it. It's another actual period piece called Napoli to New York, and it did gangbusters numbers at the box office in Italy at the end of last year. But they've yet to release it yet stateside. And it, too, is a period piece that is strangely modern. And one of the things that Kugler did so expertly is we're in the 1930s. For the majority of the film, we're in the 1930s Mississippi. But the film is in lockstep with relevance for today, with everything that we're dealing with today. And when I say we, I don't even just mean we as the culture. We as black people. I mean Americans and the world. Very, very dark time.
That's how the spirit works and the ancestors work.
Amen.
I mean, when we're in alignment with it, it all becomes revelatory. And you do things today, not for today, because you're throwing yourself into the future, but you're also there's so much going on. All right.
Experience Karen Hunter in a completely different way. Karen Hunter is awesome. The podcast.
If you like me on SiriusXM Urban View Channel 126, you're going to love me.
And Karen Hunter is awesome.
Hey, this is Karen Hunter, host of the Karen Hunter Show on SiriusXM's Urban View.
Karen Hunter is awesome is an actual podcast to bring heat and energy and knowledge and power. A 1-2 punch that I don't think you get anyplace else.
Tell the truth.
So check out the podcast wherever you get your podcast. You will not be disappointed.
All right, now let's hear from Native Land Podcasters.
What's up, everybody? It's been a minute, y'all. It's Andrew Gillum here, reintroducing myself through this mini pod. I hope everybody had a good weekend. If you're listening on Monday here live, and I know mine was eventful. That is for sure. So first point, a personal privilege. I want to wish again a very, very special and happy birthday to my life partner, my wife, my everything, my best friend, RJ Gillum, who turned blah, 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 yesterday, Sunday. And my son and the kids wrote their own cards out. I won't say her real age. I'll let her say it. But my oldest, Jackson, writes a beautiful note. And then at the end says, happy 57th birthday, mommy. And neither of those only one of those digits is in her age. It ain't the five. Okay, that's it. continuing. One more update. My kid, my youngest, Davis, breaks his damn arm in two places and does it at school. And the most wildest thing, you know, I've seen. And what is great is the kid's threshold for pain is crazy good. because shortly after I arrived to collect him and his siblings to go to the hospital, he starts comforting them. It's going to be okay, Caroline. It's going to be okay, Jackson. I thought, Davis, man, you are a soldier, because I'd be screaming bloody murder, which he was when we got there. But everybody's doing well. And I hope the same is true on your end. I am not going to take up a terribly long amount of time. I wanted to continue this conversation about resistance and organizing in the political environment that we all find ourselves, and really doubling down on this idea of doing it right where you are, in your own local community. And by the way, protests or opposition doesn't always have to come in the form of taking over a building or even lining the streets with people. A form of protest could be running for your local school board, your local city council, your county council, places and institutions locally who people often underestimate for their impact. But if you were to really analyze what probably impacts your everyday lived experience, the roads you drive on, the power, you know, that you drive, you know, pull on for your electric supply, the schools that your kids attend, and quite frankly, the type of businesses that surround where you live and maybe where you go to church, the kind of infrastructure that either does exist or doesn't, say, for instance, internet or high-speed internet or fiber being available to you, and who are the people who provide that, and then who are the people who govern the rules that allow them to do what they do if the local government itself isn't the entity that does it. And whether you're organizing an effort for a cause, for people, or running for or supporting someone running for office, there's very, 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 very little you can do without resources. Those resources can come in the form of time, which a lot of times is exactly what you use the raised financial resources to do, pay somebody to provide a service to do a thing. And if you were able to have someone's time, and the right someone's time, they would be doing that work. And so by resources, I'm being a little bit elastic in that definition, but very specifically, now I wanted to just chat with y'all about what it means to do direct fundraising, to ask someone to support what it is you're doing or to support you directly. And I will not lie, fundraising was and has been for a long time like the bane of my existence when I had to do it pretty regularly. I really, really, really hated people. Calling folks to ask for money. And I think it has something to do with just maybe my childhood and how I grew up, very proud family, you know, maybe poor by objective standards, but, and my parents, you know, in their mind's eye, and they communicated the same to us, is that, you know, we were rich in love, we were rich in family, we were rich in spirit, and you know, I was just hoping to be rich in money, but whatever. They didn't raise us with a beggar's attitude, if you will. And I've associated asking people for things, money specifically, but even other things, as sort of breaking that cardinal rule that I think was instilled in me early. And so I had to walk myself back off the fact that it is not a burden that you're giving someone when you ask them to sow a seed into what you believe in or even into you directly. Say, for instance, you were a candidate and you needed to raise money, but rather it is a sign of respect and humility to be willing to go to someone and to respect them enough to say, I want you and I need you with me in order for this thing to be possible. People love to be asked. And that's exactly what a lot of candidates don't like to do the asking. And some people are in love with it. Y'all, you know, listen, you may be in love with it. You may like the idea and the challenge. I didn't. I would much prefer to call and check up and see how you're doing than call and ask for money. But to an extent, I got over it. I had to get over it. My race for governor, we raised, you know, over $60 million through various outlets and arms, wherein I had to make, you know, significant asks all along the way. In fact, in the primary process, and those of you around campaigns might be able to relate, I would go entire days, 7-8 hours of call time on the phone, calling folks. And some folks, you know, being willing to engage me in rather extended conversation. And to a person, at the end of that day, every answer, and I'm not giving folks credit for their excuses, but for every question of around the money I wanted to raise, the answer was no from every single person to a person. And that was really challenging. And these were largely not people who I knew personally, or if I knew, didn't know very well personally, but these were people whose names were on a call list, a call sheet that was provided to me, who had the characteristics through their previous giving of looking like I would be the type of person they might give to if asked. There was a lot in that by way of what I wanted to communicate, because a lot of folks are, I think, confused about how the process works around trying to raise money. One big, I think, you know, misnomer about it, and I think this is on the candidate side more than it is the organizational or the cause side of things, and that is that that people, how do you say, are sort of just sort of, that it's the scariest thing in the world that you could possibly do is to pick up the phone and call a person whom you don't know and ask them for money. But the truth is over time, a profile gets built on those individuals. If you have a finance staff person, they'll make you aware that, hey, John Doe looks like he gives to Sierra Club and also a big supporter of criminal justice reform because he gives to, you know, whatever democracy project that might be out there. You may not know them, but by reading a little bit about them and their interests kind of gives you a little bit of the courage necessary to pick up the phone and say, hey, John, you've been a, you know, a supporter of such and such and such, and my position on the environment aligns with what I understand yours to be. And, you know, if you give me this amount, you know, we'll be able to do great things and build a beautiful future, prioritizing the things that both you and I care a great deal about. Those individuals are not unaccustomed to getting phone calls, to being asked for money. If you're nervous or a little bit uneasy about that process, please satisfy yourself by knowing that these people are used to this. And right now, at this stage, expect that if they're going to give money politically to this cause or to this individual candidate, that person or someone from that institution or that effort is going to reach out to them directly and ask them for money. And frankly, would take it as an insult if the ask came through somebody else. The other thing about asking that was really important for me to learn and to understand and to really accept, receive, was this notion of